This is listener-supported public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula. KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai Soldotna. It's 10 a.m. Wednesday, and it's time for the Kenai Conversation. I'm Jenny Nyman. The Alaska Legislature passed a $4.5 billion state budget March 29th, rushing to get out of Juneau amid the coronavirus pandemic. The budget includes $680 million for a $1,000 permanent fund dividend to be paid in the fall, and various measures to support the economy in the face of impacts from COVID-19. Governor Mike Dunleavy went on to veto $210 million before signing the budget April 6th. On this week's Kenai Conversation, the Kenai Peninsula's legislative delegation weighs in on the budget, COVID-19 stimulus efforts, and what they think needs to happen going forward. In this hour, we'll hear from District 29 Representative Ben Carpenter of Nikiski, District 30 Representative Gary Knopp of Kenai, and District O Senator Peter Michicki of Soldotna. We're going to start with Ben Carpenter. All of these conversations had to happen over the phone since our legislators are in quarantine, having just returned from Juneau. The phone connection with Representative Carpenter was a bit challenging. Took a couple tries to finish the interview, but we did manage to connect. So here is Ben Carpenter. You know, obviously, state budgets never make everyone happy, but I think this was a particularly difficult one given the stakes of everything going on this year. I mean, it's crisis on top of low revenue on top of everything else. And I know you in particular had some strong feelings about how we ended up. So I was just hoping you could maybe talk me through your thinking on your vote, what you perhaps liked about the budget, and then what you didn't like about how it ended up.
It's interesting that you start off kind of with an analysis on the crisis piece of this. I really see it as two separate crises. We've got the obvious health crisis going on, but that is on top of a crisis that we already had, which is the fiscal crisis that we're in. Not necessarily because we don't have the money, although that was exacerbated by the downturn in the economy, stock market and the oil prices, but the lack of a long-term plan and how we're going to do state government going into the future. For the last, since 2013, basically, we've been subsidizing our budget with savings. And this year, we practically eliminated our savings account, our last savings account, the Constitutional Budget Reserve. There's about $400 million in there, but the state needs a certain amount of money, and that figure is about $500 million in the CBR in order for cash flow to pay our bills throughout the year. We've used up, you know, we had $13, $14 billion in the account in 2013 timeframe, and we've used up all that savings. So now we're very limited in what our options are. And during that timeframe, we have not come up with a long-term solution for how we're going to do our state government. Our spending has decreased since 2013, largely from decreases in capital spending. And our Medicaid and education, which are our two largest components of cost drivers in the operating budget, have continued to increase. So we don't yet have an answer for that.
We lost the phone connection with Representative Carpenter right here, but we picked up on a different line. The audio quality is going to sound a little different.
I think we should have separated our budgeting process. We should have separated out the health crisis from the financial crisis. It would have been easier to communicate and understand what's going on with the state finances. The immediate need for economic relief and money to deal with state expenses for responding to the health crisis. That's an immediate need that we cannot argue too much about. We recognize that it's needed, and there's broad support, I guess you could say, for making that happen. The politics of why, what happened within the budget, the politics of it, is all of that got lumped in so that other things couldn't be argued with because the current crisis, health crisis, emergency response is tied into it. And so that's it's very unfortunate that that's the way that the crafters of the budget put things out, because it confuses people. People don't understand why there's such a conflict, or so we're so divided over what to do with the COVID-19 response. And it's all politics. It has nothing to do with the reality on the ground. Anyway, time will tell whether we got it right or whether we didn't. And the legislature can always call itself back into special session to address the immediate crisis if more money needs to be spent. Now, the only place that we can spend more money if we need, you know, more additional stimulus or the health crisis gets worse and we don't have money for it is out of the ERA. We would have to take an unstructured draw above the POMV market value draw from the ERA, which is the earnings of the permanent fund, to fund that, because we don't have any money left in the savings that we can spend. And so that's kind of where we're at now. Going into the next session, next year, I am running for re-election, and assuming that I'm part of the team that is going to look at that next year, the problem is, you know, the spring forecast is probably going to be wrong. It's just a forecast, and it's forecasting $800 million less next fiscal year than what we had projected. And we already knew that we were going to have a deficit. So this just adds to the deficit. And roughly speaking, $800 million equals about $1,000 PFD. So you can see that the PFD next year is going to be gone. There's not going to be enough money to both fund government and fund the PFD from that point of view of the money manager's point of view that says, hey, we have to pay for government somehow, and these are our available pool of money. That's not taking into account what the long-term goal is for our economy. And so this is why I have a frustration with the myopic view of just taking all of the permanent fund earnings and spending it on government, is because spending part of that money into the private sector helps the private sector grow. It helps the sector of the government that people rely on for food and shelter. It helps that grow and sustain. And the legislature is going to be forced, if you will, the political conversation will say, we're forced to take the PFD and pay for all of government, or use all of the PFD money, all of the percent of market value money, and pay for government because we don't have any other source. And if that was really the case, if we really truly believe that we would have instituted a tax now, because if we start talking about taxes in January next year, you won't see the money from that for until January the following year. It takes a while for the revenue to be collected from whatever source you're going to collect it from. And so the immediate budget happening next year, the crisis that we'll have in 21 is for the fiscal year 22 budget, we're kind of already behind the eight ball in some respects. But anyway, why I voted no on the budget is because we aren't solving the long-term crisis, and we're not doing what's best for the immediate needs of the people in regards to the coronavirus. A $1,000 stimulus now, which would have been paid from the ERA per person for a family of four, would have been $4,000. And that would have gotten people by for several months, and especially when you include the federal stimulus. Now you get a $2,400 stimulus, or maybe even $3,400 if you're a family of four. That's going to get you by for a little while, but we have that within our means to help people get by for even longer. This coronavirus economic problem is going to last, in my estimation, and it's my cloudy crystal ball here, but it's going to last several months. And we're going to have to address the problem of people not being able to pay rent or buy food. And that's going to be it's kind of short-sighted what we did in this last legislature.
And so there was stimulus efforts, but as you say, it wasn't going directly to residents. It was kind of taking a more like 10,000 foot sort of level approach of funding of various services and whatnot. Of the measures that were included in that bill, are there things that you were in favor of, or would you have rather, instead of doing what was in that bill, done a direct stimulus payment to residents?
Sitting on a House Finance Committee, we had several, probably half a dozen, maybe seven, eight business professionals call in and testify about what would be the best solutions for the economic problem that we're going to be facing. And this was back mid-March or maybe the end of March. And overwhelmingly, the concept was cash in hand is what we need. The solution that the legislature came up with was cash in hand through unemployment instead of cash in hand with a PFD. So that cash in hand from unemployment is only going to produce about 70% of your normal median income wage. So it's only fixing part of the problem. You know, I also have a job that I'm on quarantine from, and I called into unemployment last week, and I couldn't even get through. I was told to call back later. I wasn't even put in the queue to talk to somebody. I couldn't even speak to somebody. And that speaks to the number of people who are filing unemployment claims. And am I the only one that wasn't able to get through and file a claim? And how long will that last? So the problem with letting the normal system deal with this emergency crisis, the normal unemployment insurance system, is that it takes a while. It takes, and it's built into the system to have some amount of delay into it for checks and balances. And that is not what people need right now. They need immediate cash in their hands, and a PFD check could have been paid, a stimulus payment could have been paid through the PFD system in a matter of days, if not a week. And that's something that could have happened a whole lot quicker.
So currently you guys are recessed rather than adjourned. Are there things left on the table that you would like to go back and still try to accomplish this session? Or do you think we should just call it at this point and start again next year?
A whole lot of craziness happens if we go back. The budget is our primary responsibility. It's our constitutional requirement to get the budget passed. And all of the other stuff that we do is it's nice to have. The 90 days that the people said in referendum, or maybe it was initiative, I don't remember. Anyway, you've got a 90-day statutory requirement to finish your session, and then you've got a 120-day constitutional requirement. That's to do the budget, right? That's to get the budget done. That's the only thing the Constitution requires us to do. So we've finished the budget. I'm not happy with it, but it is what it is now, and I think the only reason that we should call ourselves back into session is if the immediate crisis is such that we need to spend more money to deal with it. That would be, or some other law needs to be changed, but by and large, it's most likely going to be spending more money. That would be the only reason that we should call ourselves back into session.
Okay. So going forward from next session, then, are there, I mean, obviously the budget, but beyond the budget, are there other things that got maybe left in process this session that you would still like to see make it to the finish line next year?
Yeah, absolutely. A primary concern is how do we regulate the amount of growth and spending in our government? It is not wise to just say, let's just raise revenue to meet our current expenses, because our track record is continual growth. And we don't have the population nor the economic engine in the state of Alaska to continue increasing the size of our government. There's a finite amount of money and wealth in the state based on our population and our economic output. And our size of government is too big for that. If you compare the state of Alaska's population and economic output to other states of similar size, and I'm not talking physical size, but of population economic output, our spend is about $2 billion more than what other states the same size, talking New Hampshire, Wyoming, that type. So we've got to get control of what essential service means, because right now the argument at the state level is basically whatever's on the budget, whatever we choose to spend on is essential. There's no definition of what essential is. So it's left up to interpretation every session as to what essential is. And that's kind of intellectually dishonest, right? We know, even legislators know, not everything that we spend money on is essential. It is a nice to have. There are other options out there other than just spending money. But the politics of it is we can't have that conversation. We don't have a mechanism or a way to have a conversation about what's essential. What would happen if we identify things that are non-essential? Then that would be programs that get cut, and that's not supportive of the welfare state. And you know, we had a major shift in the election in 2016, and we've seen a growth of government since then. And that's the track that we're on right now, is to have a welfare state similar to Norway or some other Scandinavian country, or many of the other states in the union, that has a high tax burden and a lot of government services. And I don't think the majority of Alaskans are there. I don't think Governor Dunleavy gets elected by the margin that he did with the opponents that he had, if the state of Alaska is looking for a high tax state and a high government service state. I don't think that's where we're at. So we go back to session next session, we've got to talk about a constitutional spending cap that controls the growth of spending and helps us figure out a long-term plan of what we want the state budget to look like in 10 years. So that would be my top priority.
Okay. You know, obviously, as linked as state government still is to a lesser degree than it used to be, but still is to oil prices. Obviously, that adds a lot of volatility then to state revenues and state resources. So it's kind of a difficult target, you know, to match revenues with expenses, whether through a constitutional spending cap when you're not always quite sure what the revenue side is going to be. So given that, would you be interested in looking at any kind of revenue generation measures, or would you rather just stick to the approach of limiting expenses?
Yeah, this is an interesting question, because I ran on not supporting any sort of income tax or sales tax until we've cut the size of the budget. And I believe human nature is such that we're not going to make difficult decisions until we have our backs up against the wall and we have no more options. And we're just about there. So as soon as the fiscal conservative says, yep, okay, let's go ahead and increase taxes, that takes all of the wind out of the sails of reining in spending and doing things more efficient. As soon as you raise the money to spend at the level at which you're at, there's no more incentive and no more need to reduce the spending. So I think the conversation has to be had. What is the future of the state of Alaska look like financially? If it's not oil revenue, what will it be? Is it going to be financial services, meaning the permanent fund dividend portion of the permanent fund dividend or the earnings from the permanent fund is going to help fund state government? If that's the future, then what's the right percentage? If we have to have an income tax or a sales tax to raise the revenue to meet spending, okay, that's fine. Then what is the appropriate amount of spending? It isn't what it is now, because it's out of control. It's the growth is going to eat us alive. Medicaid and education spending increases every year, and it is unsustainable. We would have to continually increase our income tax or our sales tax, barring some giant growth in the economy, to generate the revenue needed to cover those state expenses. So the conversation has to be, why I say it has to be is because I know the political winds and where the makeup of the legislature right now, they're just going to institute a tax, and they're not going to want to have a conversation about cutting spending. But we have to have that conversation. We have to reduce our spending and reduce the rate of growth for sure.
Since you are kind of looking back at your term now, I'm kind of curious if this is what you thought you were getting yourself into. Were you surprised by things in the legislature? You say you're running for re-election, so was it what you thought? Were there surprises along the way?
There were surprises along the way. I have always heard that politics isn't for the faint of heart. You've got to have a thick skin. There's lots of backstabbing and bad behavior and that type of thing in politics. Being that I was a newcomer to politics in general, I didn't really know what that looked like. It from the very beginning, it was an eye-opening experience for me in regards to the very personal nature of the politics. Very human problems that we have in everyday life, problems with pride, problems with trust, problems with relationships. All of those things play a huge part into getting things done, productive things done in the legislature. And what I was witnessing was, you know, that we had a pretty big cohort get elected into the House this last election cycle. And the problems that we were dealing with were relationship problems from previous years, like bad blood that had continued to exist for years. Phenomenally juvenile in some respects. And that, I think, is what surprised me the most. And I guess the experienced politician would be like, yeah, welcome to the game. That was what I took away as surprising me the most.
All right. Well, I so much appreciate your time, and especially all the extra effort it took to get a good connection here.
No, thanks, Jenny. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
That was District 29 Representative Ben Carpenter. Up next is District 30 Representative Gary Knopp.
It's an interesting stark comparison. We talked about last year. You know, we didn't get the budget last year till February 20th or somewhere in that time frame, you know, 25th, when the governor rolled out a completely entirely new budget. Didn't resemble the one that actually the Walker administration left in, you know. And so, of course, we weren't organized till the day after the budget rolled out. And then, and then that budget, you know, frankly, was pretty draconian in nature, and it was really a non-starter. So we had to start from square one. So that was last year, and we got through it. We got our budget done, sent it to the Senate on day 45, I think it was. And when we sent it to the Senate, we had a $450 million surplus in it based on projected revenues from the last fall revenue forecast, you know, and what we anticipated. And when we got to Juneau, January, like the 15th, you know, we were getting $67 barrel oil. So when we left, you know, we were down to $23 a barrel, and that all happened in the last 2 to 3 week time frame. So we spent all session working on a budget that we thought we had, you know, what we anticipated was the revenue forecast, only to see prices dive. So most of what we spent the session discussing and budgeting for kind of went out the window in the last 3 weeks and made it difficult. And so really not time to adjust based on the new revenue forecast. So we ended up taking more from CBR draw to cover the deficit just for the FY20 year, about $400 to $500 million. As you know, when we got to Juneau, the governor already had just under a $200 million supplemental, you know, his request to make up for some the fires we fought last year, some Medicaid funding. And so we started off with that big budget deficit right out of the chute, but still transmitted with what we thought was revenue of $450 million. Well, when the price of oil hit, all that surplus went away. And not only did it go away, we had to make up $300 to $400 million in revenue just for the FY20 year to finish it off. And of course, had we known that our new projections for revenue was going to be closer to $30 barrel oil, we would have budgeted completely differently for the FY21 year. And so as it turns out, we ended up taking a lot more from CBR than what we wanted to. So about $300 to $500 million this year, and just under $1 billion next year, which really depletes the CBR. It takes it down to about $400 million. And that's the one that's our shock absorber for the daily fluctuations in the state's operating checkbook, so to speak. So that's what we use to manage the daily flow of cash. So that $400 million projection left at the end of FY21 is about $600 million less than what it should be. We should $1 billion to beat out the minimum in that CBR account. So I guess the point is FY21 is going to be a very brutal year in FY22 when we get back to Juneau. So next year will be a completely different conversation.
Yeah. So as you say, the savings account, you know, at this point with that extra hit from lower oil prices, that can't bail out the budget again next year, right? It's at the point
it cannot bail out the budget next year. There's simply no money left to do that, you know. And so you talk about the perfect storm between crash of oil prices and the COVID-19 health pandemic we got going on. Yeah, the budget next year is just going to be brutal. There's going to be lots of discussions. You know, even if you impose revenue, Jenny, that will never happen fast enough to take care of that FY22 budget. So, you know, we start the FY21 budget year July 1, ends on July 1 of 2022. So when we go back, we'll be talking about the FY22 budget. Last year we took, I think it was $1 billion, a little over a billion, 1.1 sticks in my mind, for maybe 1.2 out of savings to pay the $1,600 dividend. And this year we took another just $700 million, I think the number is, to pay out a $1,000 dividend, you know. And I don't think that's going to be an option next year. I just don't see where you can do that, you know. And even, and I will project even some draconian cuts in our normal operating budget for FY22. I just don't see any other path going forward to get that done.
You've talked at length about the cuts that have come to the budget. I mean, it's not like the budget has not been cut. It's not like there's easy things to still cut at this point.
It's absolutely been cut. So since about 2014, I'm going to say we've cut about $3.5 billion from the operating budget. Yeah, so it's been cut about 40%. We're talking unrestricted general fund dollars.
Right.
So I think we had this year about $4.5 billion. So under Palin back in 2017, we were about $4.1 billion. Palin in 2008 was $5.3 billion. Palin in 2009 was $5.5 billion. Parnell in 2010 was $5 billion. Parnell in FY11 was $5.5 billion. But in fiscal year 12 under Parnell, it jumped from $5.5 to $7 billion. In 13, it went again, jumped $700 million, $7.7 billion. Then FY14, $7.3. And so 14 and 13 is when our prices started to crash. We took that big hit in the markets, and we lost about $6 to $8 billion in revenue when prices went from $120 a barrel down to $26 that year. And so when people criticize the legislature in that time for spending all that statutory budget reserve and the constitutional budget reserve, the $14, $15 billion a year criticized for spending, started in about 2014. And so that's when the UGF cut started. So they fell from the all-time high under Parnell in FY13, $7.7 billion. They fell to $7.3 the next year. Then under Parnell in 15, they fell to $6.7 billion. And Walker come in FY16, they fell another $1.3 billion to $5.4 billion, and then in Walker again $4.5 billion in 2017, and Walker in 2018 was $4.4 billion. So really right now we're pretty flat with the FY18 years as far as UGF spends. And we did a town hall here. I brought the Speaker of the House, Vice Edgman Neil Foster, who chairs the Finance Operating Budget, and the Louis Stutes Minority Whip, or Majority Whip, sort of enough for a town hall meeting. And we went through these numbers and we looked at the cuts that we've made, and we looked at inflation adjusted dollars. And if you go back to the early 80s, we are spending the same amount today adjusted for inflation that we were in mid 80s, early 80s. So in inflation adjusted dollars. So we're not, I mean, there's been a lot cut, and we're just not as fat as everybody thinks we are, you know. We talk about the permanent fund dividend a lot and how come things have changed. And the point I've tried to make with a lot of people who are full PFD people, and I want my dividends people, is the fact that in 2013 when we lost all of our revenue, and then in 2017 under Walker when we passed SB 26 was the percent of market value draw, that's what's changed everything in our state's history. That's when we had to start using investment earnings to fund government operations. Our revenue stream had changed, where revenue from taxes and royalties and oil used to make up about 90%, roughly 90% of our entire budget. Today, that's less than a third of our budget. We're bringing in less than $2 billion a year from industry now. We're bringing in 66% of our revenue from interest earnings off the permanent fund amount. So that's how our revenue picture has changed. And so point I'm trying to make there is that the old statutory formula, when you had to change your investment instrument and you started using interest earnings, the old statutory formula was never designed to be sustainable to fund an old statutory PFD under the old formula and government operations at the same time. It's simply not mathematically possible to do that without depleting all the money you have, you know. And it's a point that I try to get across to a lot of people, why can we no longer afford the full dividend, you know, and that's exactly the reason why.
So looking at definitely not a full statutory dividend going forward, and you say it's also going to be time for some draconian budget cuts. What does that look like to you?
You know, I don't know. I really don't know, and it's not going to be pleasant. I think you're going to see a combination. I think you will see a combination of some more CBR draw, and I think you will see some draconian cuts we won't like. It's what I expect you're going to see for the next budget year. I'm already talking about the future here, and we're just getting into this budget year. But you know, I think it's going to be a blend, a bunch of compromise in there. But I can tell you one thing: what we can't do is continue to take from the savings from the CBR draw. And you know, there'll be a push to violate the terms of Senate Bill 26, the percent of market value. There was an attempt made in the Senate this year to do that when they voted for the spring dividend. That money was projected to come from an extra draw from the earnings reserve account, which violates the provisions of 26. And when you start down that path, then all the naysayers will be correct. They will be right that, you know, you can't trust the legislature and they'll spend it till it's all gone. So it's really going to be about a discipline thing at this point. It's just going to be a pretty contentious year down there next year trying to figure this out. And I'm hoping that we'll actually get started on that process right now. Once we adjourn this the 31st legislature, I'm hoping we'll huddle up together and start talking about next year so we have a plan way before we get to June.
Okay.
It's too much of an issue just to work in the 2 or 3 months you're there, you know, to do it right. And so,
right. As you point out, any revenue generation measures that might be put in place next year aren't going to help next year's budget, but is it time to start looking at that stuff?
Oh, it absolutely. And we've been looking at it. We've been talking about it, you know, and everybody's all over the map on revenue. It's so many things weigh into that. I personally, if I was going to support a revenue measure, it's a statewide sales tax is the one that appeals to me. Even if we made it a seasonal 6 months, or 2 quarters, I call it 2 quarters. And, you know, and then you can target most of your tourist industry. This year, that's not an issue because we're not going to have much of a hospitality tourism industry this year. But you know, the statewide sales tax is, you only have about a third of your population gainfully employed up here anyway. So out of our 700,000 population, we only have about 230 gainfully employed. They're not all high-paying jobs. You'll pick up some non-resident workers in that as well. But I don't think what we have, because we're state so large, and all of them 230,000 people who are gainfully employed are not all the high-paying jobs. So to have a meaningful revenue stream, if you want to make it meaningful, you're going to have to do a statewide sales tax, an income tax, change your corporate tax structure, and you're probably not going to have any exemptions in there. I mean, so if you come to Social Security benefits or pension plans, I would imagine that's all on the table, you know. And so it's just not a conversation I'm looking forward to having, but I think if we can get spending out of control, generate a little bit of revenue, my favorite is a statewide sales tax. A lot of people don't like that. They want an income tax. But, yeah, they're just all talking points at this point. Nobody's, you know, when Walker was in office, we worked some of them scenarios, and I don't remember any of the scenarios generating enough revenue. By the time you got done offsetting the cost of administering them, there was a lot to gain in any of them by themselves.
Right. Okay. And then in the current budget and some of your other bills are some stimulus efforts, some stabilization efforts given COVID-19, and there's some discussion about, you know, why wasn't there a direct payment to Alaskans? Instead, the legislature took the approach of, you know, funding programs that would benefit Alaskans. So can you talk a little bit about your thoughts on one versus the other and why the legislature went the way that they did?
Well, yeah, so people were really looking forward to a spring PFD. But, you know, there's a problem with that. If you had lots of resources, you could do that. With limited resources, you can't do that. And our goal, if we were going to do any type of economic stimulus plan, was to get it to the people who were affected by this. Not everybody was affected by this, you know, by the health crisis going on and economic downturn. So if with limited resources, we wanted to be able to put programs together that would target those who were impacted, and small business and employees, mainly hospitality, as you know, the restaurants, bars, everything shut down, even retail. I mean, everybody's impacted in one form or another. But sending a dividend check out to every man, person, and woman and child in the state, all over the state, students out of state, other things, it just wasn't the best use of what limited resources we have. On top of that, we had a lot of federal resources coming in to help alleviate that problem. And what we don't know is if this crisis is going to last us 2 weeks, 2 months, a year and a half. So if people think it's crisis right now, give it 6 months, 8 months down the road, and you're really going to be in crisis mode here, you know. So we weren't going to overreact right out of the chute. We made a lot of provisions, as you know, for unemployment insurance, a waiving the waiting period, making it retroactive to March 1st, you know, benefits for those who are unemployed or self-employed, had hours reduced. So, and then, of course, the federal government come in with a big whopping $600 a week on top of the state benefits. So there was a lot of efforts being made from both state and federal government to alleviate some of this pain. And we are still trying to find ways to alleviate some of that pain. Some of our hospitality people, some of our restaurants have really stepped up and offering a lot of the food services to go. But a lot of them depend on their beer and wine sales. So the ABC board last week had passed a motion to allow them to sell beer and wine deliveries with their food products. Curbside, the factory products, beer and wine, that are manufactured and sold. So ABC board recommended that, and maybe looking at BDL licenses and other licenses up for renewal, a couple thousand dollars, extending that for a year. So we're constantly working issues with people. We've got midwives, birthing centers that can't get licensed because of the restrictions. They're trying to find exemptions and regulations, how to get them licensed without waiting for who knows how long it will be now, maybe a year. So, yeah, just, you know, we took a lot of measures to make sure the utilities weren't being shut off, people weren't being foreclosed on, car payments, house being evicted from the houses. So, which I think, you know, by and large, everybody's pretty understanding, but there are some, you know, even property owners got to pay their bills eventually. So at some point, they got to start collecting the rents. So.
And then what do you make of the governor's vetoes?
Good and bad for me. There's some stuff in there that I'm okay with. There's some stuff in there that personally, I guess I'm fond of, and I hate to see them cut, you know. I mean, even Civil Air Patrol, we put $250,000 in there just to help them pay their utilities and keep the doors open, you know. Civil Air Patrol is one I participated in for years. And so when you don't have, you know, all you're doing is buying a little bit of fuel, helping pay utilities, but them are all volunteer pilots. Work out there working for nothing and search and rescue stuff. But now you call public safety or military, now you're spending literally tens of thousands of dollars in wages and aircraft stuff, you know. I mean, it frustrates me because of the fact that that stuff falls under public safety. It's not a priority for them, you know. But we have a lot of volunteer pilots who are willing to go out there and spend their time and effort and you know, get compensated for fuel and look for people who are missing or had incidences or, you know, disaster release and search missions of what CAP does, Civil Air Patrol. But when you're paid employees to do that, it just costs a whole lot more. So $250,000 is a really relatively cheap measure for that, you know.
Right.
The other thing that, you know, we had our fire, first responders, fire people had asked for a position also in public safety that the Fire Standards Council, like the Police Standards Council, they have nobody in there. And so we funded one position to get that program up and going, help get them standards and some recruitment. And I think it was, I don't know, $150,000 or something, $200,000 position. The governor vetoed that. So Fire Standards Council won't be functional again another year. Just little stuff that more benefit for the dollar than the dollars we're spending, you know. It kind of frustrates me. I want to just talk briefly about the education. We put another $30 million in there this year for education over and above the BSA, the formula, mm-hmm. as we did last year. And I wasn't, I mean, I definitely support education. Last year I supported it. We already had it in there. The year before they got $20 million over and above. Last year, $30 million. But we were getting to the point, and I had this discussion a lot in Juneau about, I don't want to give it and have to pull it next year because we can't sustain it. It's not sustainable. We can't afford it, you know. And so the governor vetoed that one. I'm ambiguous because I'm a big supporter of education, but I'm not too awfully upset about it because I think we would have had to pull it next year anyway. And so if you're not used to having it, it doesn't hurt quite so bad. I mean, it definitely hurts, don't get me wrong, but I think we're going to see a lot of that the next budget cycle. I don't think we have a choice.
And then my last question for you is, you guys are technically at recess at this point. Is there anything that you would want to go back and try and finish up this year, or would you rather just adjourn and start again?
You know, it's nothing I really need to go back for personally. It was an interesting year because we were done in 63 days, 65 days. We were done in adjourn. This virus drove that. The virus is what drove us to get us there. So we wanted to get everybody out, get them home, get them safe, where they could isolate. We never knew how, if this was going to hit Juneau or how hard. So we were pretty concerned about that. So we ended up putting all personal legislation aside and just dealt with the budget and the emergency stuff. And that's what we did there. And so, yeah, there's things I'd like to finish up, but they're not critical.
All right. I appreciate your time and all the information, and I hope your 2 weeks goes by quickly and without any health issues.
Oh, yeah, I'm pretty healthy right now, so I'm keeping it that way.
Good. All right.
Thanks,
Jenny. Thank you, Gary. I appreciate your time.
Okay.